Today, in part two of our series, Stories to be Shaped By, the title is The Critic and the Forgiven, based on Luke chapter 7. God often acts in surprising ways, and people doubt and reject him. Jesus warns us that many are not interested in God's work, but simply want to control how God does things. Here's Pastor Seth.
Just before the story that we're going to look at today, Jesus is talking with some folks, and he makes an observation about human nature. He says, John the Baptist came. And when he came, we know he ate honey and locusts, didn't drink wine. And he made that observation and said, they called him demon-possessed. There's this really religious guy, strident, wanted to be every disciplined as he can be. And they said he's demon-possessed. And Jesus said, I came and I eat bread and drink wine. And I hang out with publicans and sinners, and the people say he's a drunkard and a glutton and hangs out with those people. Now, what's fascinating is, I guess you could have, if you pointed a spectrum of people here, no matter where you would fall on that spectrum, somebody would be able to look at you pretty easily and criticize you. The critic. It's pretty amazing to me that the people could do that with somebody like John the Baptist. I don't know hardly very many people that lived like he did and were as exemplary a man as he was, and yet they attributed to him almost the very worst of what could be attributed. Demon possession. Moved by a demon. And then they were able to criticize even the incarnate Son of God. God in the flesh. Now, over the many years, I've made a couple other observations myself, and that is I'm a pretty good critic, too. And I fight that every day. When I read this story, it's a very convicting story to me. I've also noticed that I'm not the only one that where criticism comes so easily. And, it's so amazing how, whether it's you or me, we can criticize things that are really, really important. And we can be so critical about the tiniest little things. If you're married, you have some idea of this dynamic, whether it's something really, really important or something so small. Sometimes we just have to make a point about the tiniest little things, and we forget all the many good things that somebody else has done. And all we can see is just this one thing that should be small, but it goes like this in our head and becomes something that we just have to comment about. Well, our story that we're going to look at today involves two people. One of them is a Pharisee named Simon, but I'm going to call him the critic. And the other is a former prostitute, and I'm going to call her the forgiven. She doesn't have a name in the story here. So the critic and the forgiven. And we start here in Luke 7. One of the Pharisees invited Jesus to have dinner with him, so he went to the Pharisee's house and reclined at table. Now, a Pharisee was one of the most religiosity kind of people that there were in Jewish culture. They had all their I's dotted and their T's crossed. They took the commands of God, and they made all kinds of, it's sort of like government. The people that have, there's the laws. And there are people that make all the regulations. Well, the Pharisees were like the regulation people. They just wrote all kinds of minutiae on what it meant to obey this command or disobey that command. And it just got to the point of just almost absurdity. But these guys, in their mind, were convinced that they were doing all of the regulations that they had in their head. Simon is a Pharisee. He invites Jesus over for dinner. We're going to learn sort of a dinner party. Imagine a dinner party at your house with maybe 10 or 12 people. And it says he reclined, Luke says they reclined at table. And all that means is that the tables back then were not like our tables, where we sit at a chair and eat. But they were maybe a foot off the ground, and sometimes the people would sit and eat from the table. Or sometimes they would recline out behind the table with one elbow down, prop themselves up and eat. And so that's the picture that we have here of the context. Verse 37. When a woman who had lived a sinful life in that town learned that Jesus was eating at the Pharisee's house, She brought an alabaster jar of perfume. Now, as we're going to see, word had gotten out that Jesus was in town. And as we're going to see in this story, it's sort of hinted at that she had had some kind of encounter with Jesus. We don't know if it had happened just minutes before he walked in or within a few days, but something fresh had happened with this woman. Luke says that she had lived a sinful life in that town. The idea is prostitution, most likely. The phrase, a woman of the town, meaning somebody that everybody knew her and everybody knew what she did. Eating at the Pharisee's house, she brought an alabaster jar of perfume. Now, in those days, they didn't have front doors like we have, you know, bolts and locks and, you know, no gated communities. In these little towns, most of the time, a house just had almost something like a blanket for a door or some just easily moved screen or something like that. And it was not uncommon for somebody like this, somebody in the town, when there was a famous person or a rabbi coming in to teach, to sort of crash the party, just to come in and stand on the edge of the room and watch what was happening. Now, what Luke has here is he wants you to imagine this as we read this in your mind. Imagine you're having a dinner party, 10 or 12 people, and all of you are seated around your dining room table, and suddenly you hear the creak of the door open at your house, and a woman who's a prostitute that everybody knows is a prostitute is standing in your doorway. Now, in most houses, most people would be like, especially if you were the dinner host. I mean, what in the world is going on? Probably all conversation would stop. Nobody would know what to do. The young folks call this awkward. At least my generation would be sort of like a hush came over the crowd, you know, in this kind of situation. Verse 38, she walks into the room. And Luke gives us some of the details, but I want to just help you with your imagination. She walks into the doorway. She sees Jesus. She sees Simon. She sees the other people, the guests around this table. And I can imagine her just sort of walking back to the back of the room and sort of trying to shuffle around, be, you know, unobserved around to where behind Jesus is. And she's back there just sort of quiet. And I can imagine in that room, nobody saying a word. And for her, probably all eyes are on me. I can't believe I've done this. What was I thinking? Why did I do this? She shuffles around, and then Luke records in verse 38, she stood behind him at his feet. Again, Luke doesn't record anybody saying anything, and I can't imagine anybody would be saying anything. You'd be sort of dumbstruck, and sort of a hush comes over the crowd. You know, the 10 or 12 people. But then something begins to happen inside of this woman. Something in her heart is touched. And I imagine that it was probably from something that began outside of the room. And it could, again, we don't know. If it was a few minutes before, a couple days before, don't know. But something strikes a chord in her. And I think two things happen within her. As we'll see in the story, a tremendous amount of gratitude for forgiveness, as Richard said a few minutes ago. Tremendous amount of all of the sin and weight that she had held on her shoulders and the shame that she had had for so long. She had a rich awareness that all of that had been taken somehow by Jesus and set aside. And I think the second thing that struck her is that now that all of that was gone, there's a hope now. A hope for a future, that maybe I can really be something different, and that really I really not just can be somebody different, but am somebody different at this moment. And as she's standing there, I imagine this sort of welling up inside of her, and she's realizing that there's something she'd been looking for all her life, a fresh start in life, that somebody would love her just for who she is in spite of all that she's done. And all of this wells up inside her, and I can imagine just sort of this low sort of muffled sob. And then another one. And tears come to her eyes, and they well up. Now, I don't think she's one of the, you know, I know some of you gals, may, you know, you do this thing when you start to well up, you know. I don't know if she did that, but the tears well up, you know, almost like pools. And they get to the top of that eyelid, the bottom eyelid, and then they start to come down the cheek. Doesn't have a Kleenex, doesn't have a cloth. But by this time, the scriptures tell us that she's weeping, verse 38, stood behind him at his feet weeping. And this by now, what you imagine is something of a sobbing, of a crying, out of tremendous gratitude. And I can just picture something of her tears coming down and coming together, meeting at the chin, and falling down below her, almost like a leaky faucet. Just sort of a drip, drip, drip. And she just kind of lost in the moment, filled with gratitude, filled with hope. And then she realizes that as she opens her eyes, she looks down. Verse 38, Luke records, she began to wet his feet with her tears. Now, at that point, Jesus had maybe he had sandals, maybe he was barefoot, we're not told. But either way, walking on dusty roads, he would have had dirty feet. And I can imagine there that as she's weeping and she opens up her eyes, that some of these tears had left her chin and landed on very dusty, dirty feet. And I can imagine that kind of splash when water hits dust, and sort of there's a little poop, and the dust sort of moves to the side. And after a while, you've got a little bit of mud, a little bit of dirt mixed in. And at this point, I can imagine she looks down and she's sort of mortified. Like, oh my gosh, now I've made a scene. What am I going to do? Luke records that she bent down, undid her hair, and she wiped the tears and the dust and the dirt with her hair. I imagine nobody, again, said a word. Luke doesn't record a word being said. And as I'm sitting there, thinking about this, I think, what is it that's motivating her? We've looked at something of the heart. But I have a feeling that in the middle of all these eyes looking at her from around the table, glaring at her and staring at her, and sort of that blaring right through her, we know what kind of woman you are, and we know what you've done, we know what your history is, and what in the world do you think you're doing now? In the middle of this, I can imagine that she looks up at Jesus as the only anchor in the room. And there's something that happens in that knowing look between her and him that says something to her like, I'm really glad you're here. You kind of made my day. Being with these other bozos around this table, this moron is throwing the thing, and all these guys who are just hopelessly lost and away from God, I'd rather have a conversation with you than all the rest of them combined. I have a feeling there's something in that eye contact that happened to her that prompted the next thing, where Luke records then that she kissed them. She kissed his feet. Now, I've never kissed somebody's feet. I'm married to a great gal, 37 years. I've never been tempted to kiss Mindy's feet. I don't know. Can't see a reason why that would make sense to me. I'm certain it wouldn't make sense to her. Just saying. But something is stirred in her at the deepest level. And then Luke records, and she poured perfume on them. Now, she walked in. Apparently, the only thing Luke records is something of a perfume bottle. And now she's on her knees at his feet. And there's this mess on his feet. And she's tried to clean this up. But, you know, hair and water and dust and dirt, you know, if it's me, I'm just kind of spreading the mess around. It's sort of like, and so the only thing she can think of is to take the one tool that had been her stock in trade and open it up and pour out perfume on his feet. Now, while this is going on, The scene shifts to Simon, a Pharisee, verse 39. When the Pharisee, Simon, who had invited him, saw this, he said to himself, "If this man were a prophet, speaking of Jesus, he would know who is touching him and what kind of woman she is, that she is a sinner." Now, what you read here is, and what I can imagine, is sort of this mounting disgust as Simon watches each one of these things happen. From the moment she's at the door, she's round by his feet, she starts weeping, she bends down, undoes her hair, wiping his feet, kissing them. At each level, it gets worse and worse and worse. And now, his home, I can imagine him saying, "Now my house smells like a house of prostitution. And this guy hasn't said a word. If Jesus was any kind of prophet, he would have handled this situation already." Simon finishes in verse 39 with that she is a sinner. The Greek word is hamartolos, which is a common word for sin. But the article in the Greek is put in front of this, which takes it not just from she did a sin, but that this was a condition of her life, that this was a part of who she was. In other words, what he's really saying is something like this: this woman is notorious, and everybody knows it, and Jesus hasn't done a thing about this. Now, you sort of expect, unfortunately, him to think that way and to be critical about the woman, but that's not where he starts. He starts with criticism of Jesus. And what's pretty amazing to me is that he was able to out-moral even Jesus Christ. That's quite an achievement, when you can out-moral even Jesus Christ. And at this point, the scripture lets us know that Jesus could read his mind. This was God in the flesh. He knows exactly what's going through the thought process of Simon. And he says, "Simon, let me tell you a story." And so here's our parable for today. Two men were in debt to a banker. One owed him 500 silver pieces and the other 50. Neither of them could pay up, and so the banker canceled both debts. Now, when I think about this, something in today's society, let's say that you had a credit card debt of about $50,000. That may be, what's the going rate on something like that? 17% now? Something like that? $50,000. And you were trying to pay down that debt. Now, it's not a hopeless debt. You just know it's going to take a lot of time and a lot of discipline. But let's say that you got laid off a couple years ago. And suddenly you weren't making your house payments. You just couldn't find a job. It's 2008. You cash out your entire IRA. All your retirement accounts. You keep paying on your mortgage. You have money to pay for bills. You're on the tightest budget you can be. You get a student, foreign exchange student, to come live in your home. But after a couple years, you still don't have a job. You've run through all of your retirement money, all of your savings money. Your house is now in foreclosure, and the IRS is knocking at your door for the last 3 years for back taxes, penalty, and interest. And let's say the total amount of what you owe is about $500,000. Now, you guys over here, the $50,000 credit card debt, you get a call from the credit card company. You're thinking, "Oh, no. Oh, no, you're expecting to get, when are you going to pay, you're late, blah, blah, blah." And the person introduces themselves and says, "I've got good news for you." "Really?" I said, "Yeah, we just got a check from an estate. Apparently you have somebody that died. It looks like it might be your uncle. And from the estate, they just wrote a check for $50,000 and your debt is paid." Can you imagine that? $50,000 credit card debt? And it's suddenly paid? Now you're over here. You're thinking, "Man, I wish something like that would happen to me." You get a call from your financial planner. You're thinking, uh-oh, you know, we're just going to have to write bankruptcy. It's the only thing I can think of. Financial planner says, I've got good news for you. Somebody that knows you thinks a lot about you. And I have a check in my hand that pays all of your back mortgage and late fees and brings you current. Your house is no longer in foreclosure. You think, what? What? Yeah, and there's a second check here that's going to cover your last 3 years of federal taxes and California state taxes, including penalty and interest. You are now current on your taxes. And I've got a third check here that covers all the credit card debt that you owe. The total of these three checks is $500,000. And this is what the parable that Jesus tells Simon. Now, he asks Simon, which of them will love him more? This question is sort of like, I got you, and you know I got you, but I'm going to ask you anyway so that you have to publicly commit yourself to the right answer. And you can see Simon backpedaling, and almost, because the answer is obvious, right? No question. You guys are going to be way more grateful to whoever wrote those three checks than even you will be. The answer is obvious. But Simon says, I suppose the one is snarky. It's just all over this guy. I am not going to admit that you are right. And really, that I am in the wrong. I suppose the one who had the bigger debt canceled. Jesus says, you have judged correctly. Then he says an interesting thing. Instead of continuing to talk to Simon, he turns his focus and speaks to the woman. But while he's speaking to the woman, he's really talking to Simon. There's something going on with his words towards Simon, and there's something going on with his expression and his eyes toward the woman. He turned to the woman and said to Simon, do you see this woman? It's an interesting question. I imagine if I was Simon, and if I was in his condition, I would go, duh, of course I see her. She's sitting at my dining room table making a mess of things. Of course I see her. And maybe the second thing I would have thought of, oh yes, I see her. And trust me, I know all about her. Well, Jesus was not asking, do you see her, for the answer, either of those two answers. He says, Simon, something's happened right in front of you that you don't see. But I hope you'll see it in just a minute. I came into your house. You did not give me any water for my feet. Now, it was customary in that day that whenever somebody would come to the house, you had a little pan of water and you had some towels there to help so somebody could wipe their feet. I mean, that was common courtesy for anybody that walked in. When a VIP came in, something like a rabbi, you would go over and you would wash the feet for the VIP person. And Jesus says, I came into your house at a minimum, you know, or you would think I'm a rabbi. That's how you would think of it. You did not give me any water for my feet. She wet my feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair. Now you have this mammoth contrast between a guy who is so self-absorbed with himself and his own pride and critiquing Jesus that he was just all wrapped up in himself and did nothing for his guest. And here's somebody else, the forgiven woman, where in her mind she's trying to think, what can I possibly do to repay this man who has given me back my life? Now, I coined a word, sanctification. That's not sanctification with a lisp. Sanctification. And he goes to the second thing. Simon, you did not give me a kiss. You know, you see us on the news all the time. The Middle East, kiss the right cheek, kiss the left cheek. Boy, I'm glad we don't have that in our country. But this woman, from the time I entered, has not stopped kissing my feet. Again, this stark contrast between somebody who would not even do what was customary, let alone for a VIP. And yet, here is this woman, the expression out of her heart of devotion and gratitude and the promise of a new life. What can I do to be a blessing to him? And the third thing, you did not put oil on my head, which was again customary in that day. But she has poured perfume on my feet. Again, about as broad a contrast as can be imagined are the actions of these two people. Verse 47, therefore I tell you, her many sins have been forgiven, for she loved much. Now that's the point of the parable. You guys, though you're going to be grateful for a $50,000 credit card debt, you're going to feel like you've got your life back. Kids are still going to get to come over to the house. We're still going to get to live here. We're not going to have to move. You're going to be much more grateful. Now, be sure you don't get this backwards. She wasn't forgiven because she loved much. She loved much because she was aware of the vast amount of sin that she had done. It was painfully aware to her. And the idea of having all of that, like a $500,000 debt, canceled, was amazingly aware to her. And what that prompted in her was a devoted, delighted love to give something back. He says to Simon, but he who has been forgiven little loves little. And I think here Jesus was not only speaking to Simon, but he was being quite generous. I don't know if you could say he loved at all during that episode. When I think about this, this is a parable and a story that convicts me. Because I know what it's like to be picky. I know what it's like to be picky with the most wonderful woman I know who is devoted to me. I know what it's like to be picky to my kids, present company excluded. I know what it's like in my head to be picky to my best friends or to my relatives or to the people that I work with, present company excluded, most of the time. Just being honest, and we've had many talks about this. You're with me, right? Yeah, we're in this together. I know what it's like to be yes, but. Well, you did that, but. Yeah, but. Yeah, well, that happened, but. I know what it's like to leave the air with sort of this. You just haven't done enough. Just wish you could have done more. You know, maybe in the future it'll be better. I know what it's like to be that way. I also know what that's like when it comes my way. Why did Simon love so poorly? What's striking to me about the story is nobody around that table, at least Luke records, stood up and went over to the woman and said, I am so excited for you. I see something wonderful has happened to you. I know you. I've never seen you so happy, so joyous, so grateful. Tell me what's happened. Tell me your story. Nobody does that. They are locked into wherever they're seated, leaning on their elbow. They are not going to budge. They are not going to give one ounce of other-centeredness to this woman or even to Jesus. The contrast could not be any more stunning. At the end, Jesus says to her, verse 50, I tell you that your faith has saved you. Your faith has saved you. Go in peace. Got a new life. I know what it's like to be the critic. It's really easy to be a critic. All you have to do to be a good critic is minimize your sin and get a magnifying glass out with others. Easy. steps. Those two easy steps. And do that over the course of many weeks and many months and many years. And you can take this skill and have it sharpened to a finely honed point that can even engrave in metal, "Not good enough." And maybe even smile while you're etching it. It's easy over time for your heart to slowly harden and harden and harden and to become Simon. Who do you identify with most in this story? Identify most with the woman? The forgiven woman? Who's trying to figure out a way to bless the one who's forgiven her? Give her a new life? Reflect something of the wonder of what she's experienced? Or do you identify more with Simon, sitting there, smug at your table, critical of him, critical of her, and absolutely nothing of life coming out of you to the people? Luke doesn't tell us what happened, but I have a feeling that she probably poured out all the perfume that was in here, because this represented something to her for a long time. And it was something she wanted to put behind her. And how fitting that the last bit of perfume is put out on Jesus Christ in his feet as an offering, a poured out offering of gratitude for him as she left her old life behind. Let's pray together. Father, what a stunning story this is, and how it pulls back the curtain on our own hearts, like looking in a mirror. And what a very simple parable with profound truth. He who is forgiven or thinks they don't have that much to be forgiven, that's the idea, but he who has been forgiven much, he who is aware more and more and more of how much he's been forgiven, he will love all the more. Father, in this room, there are probably people all along the spectrum between the two. And there are probably a number of us that identify some with each in this story. But all I know is this. I do not want to be Simon. And God, please help me not to be Simon. And when that ugly urge rises in me, as it will today, and again tomorrow, and again on Tuesday, please help me to see it for what it is. A rattlesnake that needs its head chopped off. Instead of feeding my pride, help me to remember with humility all that I have been forgiven.